Yeah, here is a we had a global security forum. Let me put it out here. And they were arguing, global security forum, that they're thinking that Ukraine is winning, and this the Kursk incursion was showing how weak Russia is, and they're not capable of defending themselves. And there are two concepts, Scott, when it comes to NATO and Russia. Right now, with the reality on the battlefield, we know that what's going on, and we've talked about it. But it seems that in the mind of Europeans, together with the United States, those people who are policymakers of this conflict, they don't believe that they're losing and that there is no way that Ukraine being capable of winning this conflict. How we can bring these two concepts, the Russian concept that they're thinking that they can continue this conflict and Ukraine has nothing to influence the reality of the conflict. On the other hand, the NATO countries who are thinking that they can inflict suffering on Russia the way that at the end of the day Russia would lose. Is it possible to have some sort of negotiation, some sort of mutual understanding between these two parts?
No. First of all, Russia doesn't care what the West thinks. I mean, let's just put the two realities. One is fact-based, the other one is fantasy-based. The Russian reality is a fact-based reality. Russia is going to win this war. Ukraine can't beat them. And NATO, if NATO wants a fight, then everybody dies. That's the Russian position. The NATO position is that we can bleed Russia to death by using Ukraine as a proxy. How's that working? The Donbass, the Russians just recaptured the entire 2014 original line of demarcation in the Donbass, and now they're moving past that. And you're seeing the absolute total collapse of the Ukrainian forces on the battlefield in the Donbass. One of the reasons is because the Ukrainians committed their strategic reserves to Kursk, where they're now trapped and dying. The Kursk incursion has become an absolute embarrassment for Ukraine. It's no longer seen as a political victory, it's a strategic defeat because the reserves they need to stabilize the front are stuck and being killed. There's nothing they could do about it. Political collapse. Almost the entire cabinet resigned yesterday. Zelensky is collapsing. His political support is collapsing. Economically, Ukraine will not survive this winter, and that's one of the realities that Ukrainian politicians and their supporters in the West are coming to grips with. Ukraine will not survive this winter. It's just true. When you look at it from the Russian perspective, why would you waste any time dealing with the fantasy-driven theories of the West? Russia has always said, we're willing to talk, sit down at the table, but you have to be in touch with reality. We're only going to discuss the reality of the situation. We're not going to discuss any of your fantasy, any notion that Russia is going to return the four territories that were annexed after the referendum, Kherson, Zaporizhia, Lugansk, and Donetsk. Russia's not going to allow Ukraine to have one square inch of that land. Moreover, because of Ukraine's activities, Ukraine will lose sovereign control, either temporarily or permanently, over significant other territories. Odessa, Ukraine will not be allowed to have military forces in Odessa. Whether that means Russia occupies it, who knows? Kharkiv, Sumy, just thanks to the Zelensky government, Sumy's given a death sentence because now Russia will not allow Ukraine to have sovereign control over that. And you can probably guess in Dnipropetrovsk and Mykolaiv, same thing. Any of the Ukrainian territories that border parts of the Russian Federation, which have been embroiled in this conflict, are going to be demilitarized and denazified, whether that means permanent occupation and eventual absorption or temporary occupation. It doesn't matter. Ukraine will cease to exist as a modern nation state after this. It'll be a dysfunctional state unless that it's ruled by a pro-Russian government, which is probably its future. That's the best Ukraine's going to get right there. They're not going to get anything better than that. They had a chance. Putin put a proposition on the table in June. He said, here it is. It's the Istanbul communique updated for current reality. You've lost Lugansk, Donetsk, Zaporizhia, and Kherson. You're not getting them back. But the rest of Ukraine is yours if you meet the following conditions. Ukraine opted out of that. Now they've continued to attack. They attacked the Kursk nuclear power plant. They invaded Kursk. Can they expect the Russians to keep that proposal on the table? That proposal is gone. The only thing waiting for Ukraine is unconditional surrender. The West can't accept that. The West can have as many conferences as they want. It doesn't matter. Not a single one of those conferences is going to change the reality on the battlefield. Every day the situation gets worse for Ukraine. Every day the situation gets worse for Europe. And at some point in time, this reality would hit home, so that even the European Union, the NATO propagandists, when they come together in a forum, they can't even lie to themselves anymore, because it's just so obvious what the truth is. It's going to be like that moment in the bunker in the movie Downfall, where Hitler's moving imaginary armies around and his generals have to tell him, Steiner ain't coming. There is no 12th Army. The 9th Army doesn't exist. You're moving imaginary forces. And that's what's going to happen with the West. They're going to say, well, if we do this, if we do that, we do this, you know, and eventually someone's going to have to say, you can't do any of that because none of that exists. It's done.
Yeah, right after the Kursk incursion, the Putin administration was talking about that they're not willing to negotiate anymore. But the day before yesterday, we've learned that Putin, again, is talking about negotiation, political settlement. Whenever you see this attitude on the part of the Russians, on the other hand, you see nothing coming out of the NATO countries, especially the United States. It seems to me that in their mindset, talking about peace talk, talking about political settlement is a sign of weakness. It's not just about Russia. It's in China. It's in the Middle East. It's all these endless conflicts that we're witnessing right now is because of this type of mindset that the West has right now. And they have, and nobody understands what would be the benefit out of this, because there was no benefit in Iraq, Afghanistan, in the Middle East. Right now, with China, with Russia, can we understand what there is no diplomacy? There is no mindset that think of diplomacy in the West. Why diplomacy would be a weakness, a sign of weakness in their mind?
Well, the problem is the United States, NATO, and the European Union and their allies in the Pacific have committed to a strategic concept of achieving the strategic defeat of Russia using the Ukraine proxy conflict as the mechanism. And so to them, anything that doesn't result in the weakening of Vladimir Putin, in causing Russia to pull back from demanding Ukrainian neutrality, some people would say doesn't result in Putin being removed from power and Russia returning to being a submissive nation, yielding to the demands of the West, a la Boris Yeltsin in the 1990s. Anything less than that is a strategic defeat of the West, and it is. That's the problem with overcommitting in your strategic objectives. We saw Israel do that against Hamas. We're going to destroy Hamas. We're going to destroy Hamas. Well, you can't destroy Hamas. Therefore, you've lost the war by definition, because you haven't achieved what you have sought to do, and it puts Netanyahu in a very difficult political situation. The same thing with the United States, Europe, and NATO. They've committed to the strategic defeat of Russia in Ukraine. And a Russian victory, therefore, puts them in a very difficult situation, because now not only is Russia stronger, but they've lost the proxy tool that they were hoping to achieve the defeat of Russia with, and they still have this policy, which means there will now have to be a policy reversal, which is a never good thing, never a good thing for politicians, especially in the political seasons. For instance, you can't see the Biden administration right now admitting they've been wrong on Ukraine all along. That would be disastrous for Kamala Harris. You can't see the German government admitting that it's been wrong on everything, because that ends any chance they have of staying in power next year, even though that seems to be nil. Same thing with Macron. All of these political leaders have deployed tremendous amount of political capital into the strategic defeat of Russia. So from the Russian perspective, to say we're open to negotiations, remember, Russia's saying this for a number of reasons. One, because they know that the terms they're setting, because remember, it's not open-ended negotiations, it's based upon present reality. And the West can't accept the present reality, because the present reality certifies a Russian victory. Two, Russia has its strategic objectives set elsewhere. It's seeking to destroy the rules-based international order, and it's going to do that through the strengthening of the BRICS forum, the BRICS community. Russia's hosting a BRICS summit in Kazan at the end of October. Here they look to expand BRICS dramatically. I mean, Turkey is a NATO member, and it's just accepted. Turkey's regional ally, Azerbaijan, is moving in that direction. Iran and Saudi Arabia are already in. So is the United Arab Emirates. Venezuela is talking about joining. Malaysia is talking about joining. I mean, literally, BRICS has become the global center of gravity that's rapidly outpacing whatever, critical mass the G7, possessed. It's becoming the powerhouse. One way to disrupt this is for Russia to get involved in a regional conflict that turns with global implications in Europe, in Ukraine. And so, Russia is doing everything they can to mollify, India, China, South Africa, and others who keep calling for peace. You just saw today, the Chinese and the Indians are saying, hey, we're open for, peace talks. And Russia, Russia trying to bring together a consensus-driven group in Kazan, can't say, no, hell no, we're not doing that. They're going to say, well, yeah, Russia, makes you look like a jerk. Russia has to say, sure, we're open to it. But here are the conditions. And the problem is India and China, everybody else recognize the Russian condition as being realistic, which means there will be no negotiations because the West cannot concede defeat at this point in time. I think we're going to have to see the total collapse of Ukraine. And then that the impact of that is going to have to manifest itself politically. There's going to have to be political change in the United States, in Europe, that is acceptable to a new reality regarding Ukraine. Because, as I said about Iraq, we invaded Iraq on a lie. It was going to take two or three election cycles before America could recognize that it had made a mistake because too many politicians had invested too much political capital in that decision. And that's the situation we have here today. Too many politicians have invested too much political capital into defeating Russia using the Ukrainian proxy. I don't know if it's going to be two or three election cycles, but it's going to be more than one. We might get some change in this election cycle, but then we have to purge Congress. Congress has to lose many of the members who have been giving blind support to Ukraine. Now, one of the difficulties, though, is that those same members seem to be providing blind support to Israel, and it's a much more difficult thing to remove members of Congress over the issue of Israel. So they might be immune to this, but it's going to require change. But one of the things that might push the United States off of its current pedestal on Ukraine is the collapse of the European position. And here I think we're seeing much greater momentum. I don't see Europe being able to sustain this pro-Ukrainian policy into next year. A, because Ukraine's going to cease to exist. And B, they economically, they can't do it. The Germans are in desperate straits. They need that remaining Nord Stream pipeline to be opened up. They need the continued flow of gas through Ukraine. They can't afford to totally shut down, their need for Russian energy. Neither can the rest of Europe.
Yeah, and when it comes to the understanding of this of the European Union, here is an article in the Telegraph. It's talking about there might never be a better. Do they really understand the nature of relationship between Russia and China? Because in my opinion, China is so important. We have Russia, and right now China is so important for the economy of Europe. But do they, if these people who are writing this type of articles are in line with the policymakers in the European Union, that would be disastrous, the way that they're thinking. It seems that little kids, he's talking with the little kids that don't understand anything about the reality of the relationship between Russia and China.
Yeah, I'm just trying to look up this George Allison character and see what his bio is. I can guarantee you that he is not a geopolitical person. He knows nothing about China. He's known nothing about the military. That's literally the dumbest thing in the world for anybody to say. But it just shows to the extent to which the West can deceive itself. Here you have somebody writing for the Telegraph, which has an audience in the United Kingdom, but also, you know, a global audience of people who read it. And now there will be people out there who are not well informed on Russia, China, and the reality of that relationship, who are read that and go, oh yeah, that's a great idea. I mean, it just makes no sense. But it's there, it's out there. And now you are asking me a question based upon that. It's the dumbest thing in the world. Literally the stupidest thing in the world. It's playing upon a prejudice that may have existed back in the 1980s, maybe even the 1990s, but certainly doesn't exist today. I've been to Russia. I know that really pisses off the FBI and the Department of Justice. But the problem about going to Russia is you get to see firsthand what the reality is. In Novosibirsk, you know, they're welcoming Chinese investment. Chinese are welcoming Russian investment. It's a two-way street. I mean, China invests more heavily into Russia, but there is a two-way street. Russia gives China independence, you know, on energy independence. Doesn't have to worry about the potential of blocking of strategic sea lanes of communication. And not oil. It's all coming in from Russia right now. They match each other geopolitically by helping Russia stand up to NATO and the West in Ukraine. Russia helps China stand up to NATO and the United States in the Pacific over Taiwan. It's a mutually beneficial relationship that extends into BRICS. You know, Russia and China are the heart and soul of BRICS. They're trying to get India to come in. You know, and China needs India to come in, and India won't come in if it was just China, but Russia helps doing that. So the Russian diplomacy plays a role in this. The bottom line is these two nations have a relationship that extends well beyond the genuine, sincere friendship that exists between Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping. I mean, that's one thing. But the two nations now are strategically aligned, and the more they work together, the more comfortable they get with each other. And I don't think there's, you know, there are a handful of right-wing Russian nationalists who are very fearful about the lack of Russian population in the Far East. And, you know, they're concerned about the Chinese flooding the border and taking over. That's just not a scenario that's even worth discussing, because it's not being considered by China. And the Russian leadership, the real Russian leadership's not worried about it, because it doesn't manifest itself. They're not worried about what they're working for is building a mutually beneficial relationship with China based upon parity, equality, mutual respect. Everything that Mr. Allison's article apparently pretends to believe doesn't exist.
Yeah. And getting back to the conflict in Ukraine, here is Zelensky talking about if they're going to do again, they're going to attack Russia on the Russian soil.
We capture Russian troops to replace.
Нам не потрібна російська територія. Я це завжди.
We don't need the Russian territory. Our operation is aimed to restore our territorial integrity. We capture Russian troops to replace them with the Ukrainian. We tell them, you know, we need our military soldiers in exchange with the Russian ones. The same attitude is to the territories. We don't need their land.
Is the plan to take more territory?
Or I will not tell her. Sorry, I can't speak about it. It's like the beginning of our this Kursk operation. With all respect, I can't speak about it. I think that the success is very close to surprise.
But conceptually, you have this territory now. You say you don't want to keep it long.
Conceptually, we will hold it. Conceptually, we will hold it.
Yeah. And do you understand what he's talking about? Because it seems to me that he's just not confessing that they want to do this again and again if they're allowed to do this.
Not what he's saying. Well, this is a desperate man who is playing off of a Western narrative. And it's words and words and words. Kursk is collapsing. They're dying. The strategic reserves. There's nothing there. I mean, it will take some time because the Russians aren't in the business of sacrificing their troops, and so they're going to do it slowly. But it's over. There's not going to be a second Kursk. Where are the Ukrainians going to get the troops? Meanwhile, on the Donetsk front, the front has collapsed. We may find the Ukrainians having no choice but to run pell-mell for the Dnieper River and get on the other side and try and create a barrier while they desperately try to cobble together something that resembles a defense. But, they are collapsing as we speak. And regardless of where they end up by the time the snow falls, Ukraine will not survive this winter. Again, I just reiterate that reality. So this drivel coming out of Zelensky's mouth is meaningless. It literally is meaningless. The only thing that matters isn't what comes out of his mouth. It's what happens on the battlefield. That's all that matters.
Yeah. And do we know, Scott, what was happened to that F-16 and that jet's crash? And who did that? It was on the part of Ukrainians? It was Russians who hit this F-16 or something else?
Well, we don't know with absolute certainty because nobody's talking about it in those terms. Initially, there was talk that the aircraft might have run into a Russian drone and suffered a malfunction. And so the Russians were like, ha, 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 we shot it down. And then the word came out, no, a Patriot missile shot it down. And then the Ukraine said, no, a Patriot missile didn't shoot it down. It was brought down through, technical malfunctions, pilot error, things of that nature. So when you look at that and some other information, you can cobble together what I think is probably the most viable scenario. The F-16s that Ukraine have are configured in air-to-air mode. They're not air-to-ground delivery systems yet. They're designed right now to be employed in a similar way that American aircraft, Israeli aircraft, British aircraft were deployed back in April to protect Israel from Iranian cruise missiles, drones, etc. Sort of a forward line of defense to visually or through radar or heat acquire a target and shoot it down with an air-to-air missile. The F-16 carries a combination of Sidewinder missiles, which are heat seekers, and AMRAAMs, which are radar missiles. That appears to be the profile that he was flying on that day. Now, he is part of the way they did it in with Israel is that the aircraft flew forward of the surface-to-air missile umbrella, the Iron Dome, etc. So they were out of harm's way. You didn't have aircraft flying over Israel. They were flying into Jordanian airspace, so that there was automatic deconfliction. They would shoot down as many targets as possible, report incoming targets in, and then those would be engaged by the surface-to-air missile umbrella. Here, it's the opposite. The surface-to-air missile umbrella is forward. So the F-16 either acts as a backup to that, meaning that if the Russian missiles penetrate the air defense, it's there as a backup to intercept and shoot down. Or it's trying to operate in coordination with, and that's a very tricky thing because now you have to have very intimate deconfliction and it has to be trained. I mean, I used to be involved in this kind of work in the Marine Corps, and the level of training necessary to deconflict surface-to-air missiles with aircraft is a very tricky thing. And if it's done wrong, planes get shot down. So we have a plane configured to air-to-air mode to engage targets, working in an environment where it has to maneuver to stay out of harm's way from a surface-to-air missile engagement. What I think, and also remember, these are very old aircraft. They've outlived their operational life. But that's the only reason why the Ukrainians have them. I've said this all along. They're not getting the best F-16s. They're getting ones that NATO literally is not allowed to fly anymore. Why? Because they've exceeded their operational life expectancy and they can't be upgraded. Why? Because after a while, metal becomes brittle. These planes were designed to take a certain stress load, G load. They were designed to do certain maneuvers. Now, when you put weapons on it, that increases the stress. It's just simple physics. You know, it's the same, spin something around, put a weight on it, spin around. There's even more stress on the string because the weight, the centrifugal forces, et cetera. So now you got this plane with things strapped onto it, pulling maneuvers. this pilot is not an expert pilot. He doesn't know the aircraft very well. He knows how to take it off. He knows how to land it. He knows how to go left, right, up, down. But he isn't somebody that's actually practiced, you know, a scissor-esque maneuver, you know, to fall down and then hook over here to evade. He hasn't practiced that. And the airplane he's flying can't handle it. Now, he may have done something like that when he was flying MiG-29s and Su-27s. And this is what I said all along. The problem is when these pilots are going to be placed under stress, they go to muscle memory and they fall back on that which they know. They're not very good in the F-16. They don't know how to use it. He's up there in the sky. He's trying to intercept a target. He gets inside a Patriot umbrella. The Patriot launches. He has to now evade the Patriot launch because the Patriot's locking on him. We've listened to Russians do this. Su-34s, Su-35s operating in the area. There's audio tapes released by the Russians, and you can hear the G-force as the Russian pilot is pulling to get out, grunting as he's the grunt maneuver to get out because he's pulling G's. He's stressing that airframe, but these are new aircraft. They can handle it. This F-16 pilot's down there. Now, he was told, don't overstress the plane. Plane can only do so much. Long, slow turns, you know, slow climbs, all this, but don't do this because it will fall apart at the seams. And I think the Patriot got launched. He went into MiG-29 mode. He over-yanked the airplane, and the airplane fell apart in the sky. That's what I think happened, because it makes sense. All the facts line up. It could have been something else. We won't know. You know, in theory, there's an investigation that happens. But I don't see the Ukrainians pulling the pieces of this F-16 out of the ground, putting it in a hangar, reassembling it, coming in, X-raying it, trying to reverse engineer the problem to find out what happened. I just see them trying to sweep it under the rug because they don't want to admit that they were given a bunch of junk from the West and that it'll never help defend Ukraine, and that this whole concept of the F-16s are coming to our rescue is just fantasy.
Yeah. We had Vladimir Putin inviting Erdogan to BRICS in Kazan. And on one hand, on the other hand, we have the protests right now in Turkey against the US warship in Izmir, and which in their mind is for the support for Israel. And how we can understand the behavior of Turkish government right now? Are they trying to keep the balance between the East and the West, or the population, the public opinion, because of the conflict in Gaza between Israelis and Gaza and Palestinians, is just forcing the government to go to the East?
I think Erdogan has made a strategic decision. He hasn't vocalized this outside of his inner circle, but Turkey's future is not with Europe. Europe doesn't want Turkey. That's just the reality of it. If you recall, Turkey almost went to war with France over Libya. And Turkey's almost gone to war with Greece all the time. NATO member. The European Union doesn't want Turkey. Russia's turned out to be Turkey's best friend, helping empower Turkey geopolitically by providing the Turkstream pipeline, which helps position Turkey to be what it always wanted to be, a regional gas hub. Something the United States and Europe aren't a fan of. Turkey is looking at BRICS. Turkey's looking at this Eurasian Economic Union. Turkey's looking at Eurasia in general and saying, that's what we want. Remember, Erdogan is sort of an Ottoman, old Ottoman guy at heart. And so he's looking at the Turkic peoples of Central Asia, and he's saying that's a place where Turkey can have influence. But he also has decades of secular, a heavy secular presence in the Turkish ruling establishment that he can't just do away with overnight. Many of the Turkish military have strong NATO roots. Now, he's purged a lot of that. I think the senior leadership, right? He learned from 2016 that you can't trust the NATO-trained generals. So he's purged those out. But there's still residual there. There's still elements in there. The Turkish population, it's hard to make that divorce, that strong divorce. And so Erdogan's riding this out until it becomes obvious what the solution needs to be. It was like Putin. You know, Putin couldn't divorce himself from the West. It took the West sanctioning Russia to liberate Putin, to say, I'm done with the West, because there was too much too much of Russian society was intertwined with the West. Too much of Turkish society is intertwined with the West. You can't have a hard divorce. It's going to have to be a gradual process of de-entangling, or a crisis will have to happen similar to what the sanction of Russia did that liberates Erdogan. But what Erdogan doing is positioning himself right now to make the jump that inevitably will be made. Turkey will stop being a NATO member sometime down the future. And when they do that, it's the end of NATO. NATO will collapse like a house of cards.
Just to wrap up this session, how did you find the latest talk of Netanyahu arguing that they're going to eliminate Hamas from Gaza? And in the map that he was showing to us, there was no West Bank on the map. It seems that they're just, it just disappeared, that they're considering as a part of Israel.
This is the problem with Netanyahu. He's so detached from reality right now. He's playing to a domestic political base. And he's gambling on the fact that the United States won't do anything about it. And we saw that Mr. Miller, the State Department spokesman, when asked about this map, said, I don't want to comment on it. I don't want to comment on it, because to comment on it would be to expose the lunacy of Netanyahu and his far right coalition, which is genocidal, apartheid state. And that map proves it. That map literally proves it. But nobody wants to admit that the International Court of Justice is right in indicting these people and accusing them of what they've accused them of, genocide and being an apartheid state. Netanyahu is you know, playing a very difficult political game. He's under tremendous pressure from within and from without. And if he makes one mistake, you know, normally people would say that's a mistake, posing with that map. But what that did is actually solidify his standing with a significant segment of Israeli society that went, yes, greater Israel, that's what we want. At a time when he's under pressure to have a ceasefire in Gaza, so to bring the remaining hostages home. You know, so he's doing this delicate political balancing act that is going to alienate a whole bunch of people, get people mad, but that's what he does best. He plays them off each other, and through their anger, he continues to survive. But at some point in time, he's going to take a fall. And I think events are going to catch up with him domestically and externally. I don't think he can continue this balancing act forever.